wonderfuls. Welcome to episode 335 of the podcast. Boys of Summer continues with my fantastic guest, the wildly talented Chris Sullivan. I am a fan of his, but you know what? No, I'm a friend of his. And I know that you will absolutely love this episode because he's a very special person. So that's not a sarcastic. It 100% was not. Please enjoy. Check out his upcoming podcast, In Love. I believe it is not released yet, but it will towards the end of the month. But I will remind everyone. And that's it. I hope everyone's having a wonderful summer. Yeah, tell me about Wayne White. Oh, but you'll have to hold your mic because it might yeah, get muffly.
He was the production designer for Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Oh, shit.
So he's a painter, a sculptor, a puppeteer, a musician, all of these things. And he's just kind of an insane, like, bearded mountain man.
Yeah.
And so he started his, like, introduction into the world of fine art was he would go to thrift shops and buy like $2 landscapes, yeah, and then paint word paintings into them.
It's got to be what's at Fred 62.
Yeah,
because
sure,
that's like, if you told me that Fred 62 is a cafe on Hillhurst, here on the other side of the world, yeah, where you've come, but they've been there forever. And Fred 62, because it has that sort of like 50s
right,
hipster diner, I wouldn't be surprised if he like design the stuff inside the diner as well.
Right.
I have absolutely nothing to base that on, but it's very Pee Wee's Playhouse, yeah, in the sense of you can easily see like a, yeah, Paul Rubens sitting down in the 80s.
Yeah, he is. I think that's how he got started. It was like a cafe in Nashville, like that.
There you go.
Right, somewhere in Tennessee, wherever he's from.
Those Nashvillians. Where are you from?
They're hip. Sacramento, California.
You are, yeah, from Sacramento.
I was born in Palm Springs.
Okay.
And then moved to Sacramento when I was like 5 or 6.
Okay.
So grew up in Sacramento.
So you have the expected snobbery that comes from being a state's capital.
Listen.
Yeah.
If there's any city that requires your respect, yeah, it's Sacramento.
Yeah.
Very rural place.
It is.
Outside. It's where they found gold.
Yeah.
You know?
My dad writes books about ghost towns and old mining camps and stuff.
Amazing. So you
from
know
the American
all about,
West. So
you
he's
know
a
all
big,
about Lodi.
He really made me a nerd. Yep.
And Placerville.
Mm-hmm.
Hangtown. Sacramento, Fresno, Modesto. And then, yeah, came down here for college and then lived in Chicago for a while and New York for a while. And I'm now back full circle.
Where did you go to school down here?
Loyola Marymount.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was one of the colleges that has a theater. Like that's sort of,
yeah, it does now.
Solicits, but it feels
it
to me that when I
now
went to,
yeah,
when I was looking at colleges, that was one that approached me about theater,
oh,
stuff.
Cool.
But
and
I didn't
like,
have any money, and
I,
yeah,
can't do it.
I was very,
I've got
grounded about the idea of borrowing any money at all for theater.
Fair
I,
enough.
I,
fair
I,
enough.
I really,
I probably should have been more. I probably could have done my parents a favor.
What are you going to do?
What, not much.
So your dad was the governor.
Dad was the governor of California.
Uh-huh. Living right there in Sacramento.
Living right there in Sacramento. Also starred in a series of films called The Terminator.
Oh, wonderful.
I don't know if you're familiar.
I am familiar. Those, I'm familiar with two of them.
Two of them. And then
and where the others?
The first Alien film.
Mm-hmm. Wait, he was in the...
The first, pardon me.
Predator.
Predator film.
Yeah.
Not Alien.
Wow.
Not Alien.
You guys are not that close.
No.
Nor do you know
well,
much
he,
about iconic
hard,
cinema.
Well, he keeps people at an arm's,
yeah,
length. You know, he's not someone you get to know.
He keeps people at arm's length.
He keeps people at a very large
arm's
length. Exactly.
Have you seen the... I haven't seen it, but I've heard tell that the Ronald Reagan governor's mansion that is, I think, maybe no longer the actual governor's mansion is,
correct,
like a sight to see.
I haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. My dad kind of forbade any of us visit it.
Uh-huh.
It kind of told us all that that we weren't allowed to acknowledge the existence of any governors before or after.
Mm-hmm.
His,
sure,
governorship.
Sure. What if we kept up this for the entire podcast and you just had to build up,
yeah,
a
what,
fake childhood?
I don't know what you're talking about.
centering around
the idea that Arnold Schwarzenegger is my father. You never know these days.
Now we've said it, so we've killed it, which I feel pretty good about. What? Why were your parents in Sacramento? Was there
my dad was
reason?
A home builder, and he got a job up there, and so yeah,
like full on, like a contractor,
like a vice president of a home building company.
Okay,
and so they built tract homes, and
that's a good spot
kind of suburban,
to grow out the sprawl.
Yeah, and the sprawl is real. Is real.
Yeah.
So Sacramento is still a place we visit.
But your parents are...
They're still there.
They are still there. Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a younger brother who lives here in Los Angeles, in Brentwood. Have you heard of it?
I have. Mm-hmm. I have.
It's a very nice neighborhood.
It is a nice neighborhood.
I live in Marina Del Rey.
Yeah.
Which is the Florida of Los Angeles.
It is. How did you... You know, it's so... I'm always so interested in non-LAers, which most of us are, how they come to select their various pockets. Because it is a huge decision. And
seriously.
And it seems like it has so much to do with what you... Who already live there or
and
whatever.
And you live on the tip of a mountain.
Yeah. I need those hills.
Overlooking the Hollywood sign.
Well,
literally.
Listen.
No, literally. It's driving up here. So romantic. The little tiny windy roads, which were built in 19...
Yeah, they've been, this is 15. The Beechwood Canyon, which is not exactly where I am.
Right.
Stalkers is the most iconic sort of the entire ride of driving up Beechwood. Sure. You're just staring at the Hollywood sign.
And you get to the tip of a mountain. Mm-hmm. And that's just go to the tip of a mountain and that's where you'll find... Janet Varney. So a friend of ours, when we first moved here, we were living inland, and we found ourselves being drawn to the beach three times a week. Mm-hmm. So we were taking that commute three times a week. And so a friend of ours had a place out there, and so we rented for a while. And then we just a week ago
moved into
our first house.
Congratulations.
Real adult stuff.
Yeah.
Which has been both a joy and an exhilaration, and also terrifying and anxiety inducing and a real challenge.
What is the size? I mean, not to get into square footage, but I was just having a conversation.
2,200.
Yes, okay. All right. I was just having a conversation about how we are very good as a species, at least the Western world, to sort of fit the size we're in.
Janet.
Like, it could be the tiniest studio and you'd be fine, or it could be a giant house. Somehow will fill that space.
When we lived in New York, we lived in a 350 square foot, 400 square foot studio apartment.
There you go.
We fit fine.
Yeah.
A little cramped.
Yeah.
We then lived in this apartment over here, one bedroom, two bath, an office, 1,000 square feet, fit fine. We move everything into this new house. We don't have enough room for the shit that we unpacked out of closets. We're like, how is it that we unpacked this apartment and moved to a house that's twice the size of the apartment we were in, and we can't find a place to put all this shit?
That's really funny.
It's really funny. And
did you have a purging before as well? So it wasn't even that.
Yes,
it was we got rid of stuff.
We left half our furniture.
Yeah.
And we can't, I had real embarrassment halfway through the move of just all the boxes of shit that I'm like, I know I don't need this. I know I don't want this.
Yeah.
I don't even like this.
Yeah.
But I'll hold on to it for 10 years.
Right.
And let it just sit in the closet and hold psychic and emotional space.
That's right.
And when everything falls apart emotionally and mentally, I won't know to blame it on the binders of the scripts of the plays I did in college.
Yeah.
That are holding up shelf space.
I definitely have some stuff like that. And I feel like I purge stuff like that more than some people. Like I'm not great at keeping mementos that I'll probably wish I had
maybe
20, 30 years from now.
Maybe
but
you will.
What if I've utterly forgotten?
Yeah. Like my wife and I just went through that. I am a big, a collector of framed things like art and things. And I think part of it, like we looked at the stack of things and Rachel said, none of this applies to me. Like none of this, I don't vibe with any of this.
Right.
And
right.
I'm like, but these are like, I've had these for a long time. And so the question is, do I like them or have I just had them so long that they give me some kind of comfort because my brain knows what to do when I look at it.
Right.
And
yeah,
so,
if you, especially if you're a person who's moved or have an irregular life the way we do in terms of our careers, like having those sort of touch points where you feel like that's a constant.
Do I need to drag the old version of myself into the new house?
Right.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Even though I really want to hold on to this stuff.
Are you gonna?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's gone. A lot of stuff's getting thrown.
You guys don't have kids, yeah?
No.
Yeah.
We did, but we got rid of those two.
Yeah, like in the purge. That's the old you.
We were like, if we're going to get a house,
kids
will fuck up a house.
That's right. That's right. Smart.
So we purged them.
Great.
We put them on Let Go. Have you heard of this app?
No.
Sorry,
but
you're not sponsored by them.
I mean, no, I'm not.
You take a picture, you put a price on it, and you say, come get it.
Yeah.
And that's what we did with them.
Well, how was that different from any other? It's just like.
Oh, it's exactly the same.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Maybe there was some Zen quality it that was like the let go of it all.
No,
you have to listen, everything's the same as like Craigslist or eBay, but you have to write a poem that you tape underneath the object that is also emotional baggage.
Right.
That then when you release that item.
That haunts the apartment of the next person.
Then that goes away.
The next person who hangs it is like, why do I have this new anxiety?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's the framed oil painting of Bill Murray.
Don't get rid of that.
It's gone.
What do you, I know we're sort of joking about it, but do you give credence to the idea of sort of like whether it's actually literally energetically something is sort of holding on to energy or
absolutely.
Just that it's you and the relationship you have
to absolutely.
It? Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Things hold energy. Even if it is a memory or a sense memory, even if you're unaware that you are, you know, having those connections, those neural pathways are, if you have a piece of artwork from your childhood bedroom, that's now in your adult bedroom, those neural pathways are still active, still connected. And the same thing goes for spaces. I mean, you can feel it. You feel it most, or I've felt it, maybe just because where I've spent a lot of my time is in theaters, because there's so much energy expended in those spaces, not only by the performers, but by the audiences who witness them. And that's why I think places feel haunted, and I don't mean haunted by in the traditional sense.
Like,
but
there is one person who is unresolved. Who
is. But there are spaces that contain those energies, and houses can feel that way when you move in, or whatever's. It's essentially the long term version of you know, walking into a room with two people who've just been fighting. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have specific theaters that you absolutely immediately felt something very, very positive, or felt something that was sort of uncomfortable or strange?
Yeah, there's been a lot of theaters. My first big job out of college, I toured with this Broadway one-man show called Defending the Caveman. And so it was just me by myself. And I did close to 1,000 performances over the course of 4 years.
Wow, that's a long time to be doing that show.
Yeah, it was a long time.
Were you doing stuff in between? Were you hiatusing in a sense?
No, because I got the job when I was like 23, and then I would travel, and then I'd have a little time off, and I didn't have an apartment because I was traveling enough to where I was like, well, I don't want to keep a place. And so then I lived with my brother for a while, or I'd go, I've got 2 weeks off, well, I'll go visit a friend, or I'll travel to, you know, take a little vacation. But it was a very like that type of lifestyle led to a very ungrounded mental state. I just felt homeless and kind of ungrounded and shaky all the time.
How many different were you just within the United States? Were you taking? Was it going?
Yeah,
all over the world?
Around the world in that, like, I went to Montreal or I went to Bermuda, but mostly I think I'd been to 35 or 36 of the states. And there are definite theaters that you walk into, mostly the older ones, obviously the newer construction ones, you know, feel new, but yeah, I'm trying to think. Chicago definitely has a bunch. Like I spent 5-6 years in Chicago, and even walking into, like, you know, Improv Olympic or Second City or the theater I was at is now the Laugh Factory, but it was the Lakeshore Theater when I first started doing the show there. They're spaces that that have evolved with the time, whether they started as vaudeville spaces and then became silent movie theaters and then became actual movie theaters and now have transitioned back to actual theaters. Chicago, yeah, definitely has a lot of those types of rooms.
Are you now you immediately yeah. made the connection with Sacramento to the sort of gold rush era. Mm-hmm. And in thinking about this sort of histories and the energies yeah. of places, are you the kind of person who, when you go to a new place, you're sort of interested in how it came to be what it is? Or,
oh, sure.
You yeah. know?
Yeah, the current history. I want to see the photos of the area 100 years ago. You know, Venice, Marina del Rey, even where we lived on the peninsula, you know, used to be oil derricks. And there were a couple of like ranch style California craftsman houses that are still there. But it was mostly just drilling for oil on the beach. And Chicago is definitely that way. And people in the bigger cities, and I guess in the small towns too, are good about, you know, keeping those type of records.
Mm-hmm.
About what the place used to look like or what it used to be used for. In New York, the buildings are labeled.
Yeah.
Like you can look up and it'll say like Horton's Ice Cream. And you realize that building that's now mixed use apartment with a, you know, deli in the bottom used to be like this ice cream factory or whatever it was. But
I don't feel like we get that. I'm from Arizona. And so certainly I have a very strong connection to Spanish and Mexican history, mm-hmm. but there just isn't.
How does that play out in your life?
I don't know.
Did you grow up learning? Like, was that what was taught there?
I did. I mean, I went to school in a magnet program my elementary school years.
What's a magnet program?
A magnet program. You know, magnet program.
No, explain it to me. I know I've heard it. And
yeah.
then I'd be like, oh, yeah, magnet.
Magnet.
And by no the, idea what
side
it means.
Note, I did not know that those drillers were called derricks until like a day ago.
Yeah.
I had no idea what to call them. I was like, you know, the crickets.
Yeah.
The grasshopper things. Yeah.
They yeah, look the like seesaws.
Bugs.
The
right?
seesaws.
The oil bugs.
Yeah, the oil praying mantises.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That would be like the Tucson school district wanted to diversify so that you wouldn't just go to your neighborhood school.
Got it.
That you would go. And so there was a whole system of like a bus picks you up. You go to a different school to mm-hmm. transfer mm-hmm. buses because mm-hmm. everybody from all these different neighborhoods gets on
wow.
the school bus
wow.
and goes to. So it's like, you know, you had to be
out.
It's
in the news these days.
It starts
busing.
Real early.
Yeah.
In the morning. Yeah.
yeah I'm
in the
sure.
winter, it's just dark for such a long time because it takes like an right. hour and a half to get to school when all said and done.
Sure. But that's when you do your homework.
That's when you do your homework.
On the bus.
Or get bullied in my case.
Uh-oh.
But that was.
Bullied how?
Oh, just like,
verbally.
You know. Yeah. And just there was a girl who decided she didn't like me because I was one of the last stops.
And she was short.
No, she might have been taller than me, which is saying a lot because I was a tall kid.
You're tall.
I'm a tall gal.
Lady.
She would keep 5'10"? Make everyone 5'10". Okay. She would make everyone put their knees in the aisle so I couldn't sit down anywhere. So I would either just
she
have to
like,
stand
Jan's
next
coming.
To the driver.
Knees in the aisle.
Isn't that crazy? A full bus load of people who I didn't know because I didn't go to school with any of them.
And
they all went to different schools
it.
And they all
and
did
they
it.
They all did it.
And I stopped. For those of you who listen to the podcast, I feel it's probably been years since mm-hmm. I spoke about this, so it's probably okay. But I started faking sick because I didn't want to have to face that and get on the bus. And eventually my parents were like, I don't think she's sick. And
yeah.
they took me to a doctor, and the doctor was like, something's going on up here, Tab's
mm-hmm.
head.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally I admitted what was going on, and then it turned into a whole kit and caboodle where they like
wow.
called my principal who
sure.
somehow put together where she went and he called her principal.
Because who knows where this kid turned
yeah,
out. This kid didn't even school. Go to any of the schools.
She's never, in
she
fact.
She was just a bus rider.
In fact, there was no student except in 1950.
It was a ghost.
That's right.
It was a ghost.
A very influential ghost
yeah.
that everyone was too afraid of to even tell me it was a ghost.
Should have known by the pedal pushers.
Should have known. But yeah, she, so anyway, that was the magnet school. The ones that I went to were arts and performing mm-hmm. arts kind of based, so there would be the extended day program where you would take art classes of some kind, two different classes, so you're mm-hmm. going home at like 5:30, mm-hmm. or if you're doing a play
sure.
we would go home at like
sure.
7 and so and that the schools that I was going to were in the historic barrio of mm-hmm. Tucson mm-hmm. and the first 6 years of school for me were English and Spanish
sure
and then I went to
are you still fluent?
Not at all, and
dang
I never
it.
was. But I do have very strong positive feelings about sure. Hispanic culture and
sure.
those their holidays are like more meaningful to me mm-hmm, than mm-hmm. you know than some most right. just sort of Western American holidays. But
sure.
But this isn't just about me.
Christmas,
but it's mostly
Christmas.
About
do you
me.
Love it?
Las Posadas.
Oh Jesus!
It's the same. All more right. or less.
All right.
But different songs. Oh. And adorable children dressed as angels carrying a creche through neighborhoods where you knock configured doors
yeah.
and you and Mary and Joseph ask for shelter and they're turned away and turned away and turned away. And then they're allowed in and then everyone has
and
delicious hot chocolate and cookies.
For that year.
And then you have to live there for that year. It's an exchange program.
Until
yeah.
the next year.
It's a little complicated.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
We're both doctors and...
Nope, just me.
Okay, well, Sydney's a doctor and I'm a medical enthusiast and we create... Okay. Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
Every week I dig through the annals of medical history to bring you the wildest, grossest, sometimes dumbest tales of ways we've tried to treat people throughout history.
And lately we do a lot of modern fake medicine because everything's a disaster, but it's slightly less of a disaster every Friday right here on MaximumFun.org as we bring you Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. And remember,
don't drill a hole in your head.
So you settled in Chicago because like five, of Defending the
yeah,
Kingdom?
Yeah, so the show landed there and we did this like sit-down run in this 300-seat theater that ended up running for like 14 months. And then by the time that was done, I had started training at I.O. and had gotten my first agent, which I had not been able to, surprise in Los Angeles, no one cared about my theater degree.
So when you were so how long were you here that you tried to do
two,
that when you were
two and a half years.
Just after Loyola Marymount
yeah.
you were
yeah, like
oh
years.
I'll give this yeah
and every day I would send out submissions and then drive around to agencies
God, that's
and realizing
so
like
stressful
right and yeah. also not how it works
like, I know it's such like, a weird but like but when people ask me what should I do how does it work I'm like yeah. I don't know
I have no idea
everyone's story is different
everyone has found a different way into
yeah.
this industry and none of the ways in will apply to anyone else.
Right.
Which is why it's so frustrating.
It's just so ephemeral. It's so
yeah,
like
yeah,
snatching
yeah.
at nothing
yeah.
in the
it's
air.
It's like these little time warps open up and you just have to be standing there to jump through.
Yeah.
But Chicago was my way in to the industry. And mostly my way into working. Like I just wanted to do theater. I had no idea how to do on camera things or film or television or any of that stuff. And so what I did know was theater. And so I started working there and in Chicago, if all of the theaters kind of work on the same schedule, so you can set up your work schedule for years in advance. Some people,
wow.
And then that's where I met Rachel and we were there until 2010 when we got married and then 5 days later leading up to our wedding I had got asked to audition for this Broadway play and so we got married and then 5 days later drove to New York.
Wow. For that audition?
No, for the
you got
play.
It.
I got it.
You got
then
it. Then you're
to start
married
rehearsals,
then you went to go do it.
To start rehearsals and just kind of packed up and
that's so Chicago, that's a good you know, that's a sort of good middle step from
yeah.
being, you know, a Californian
that's
to Chicago to New York.
That's like, the only thing I tell people
yeah.
who what should I do? I'm like, you know what you should do? You should move to Chicago.
Yeah.
And you know what? Nobody wants to hear that answer.
Yeah. Except people who already know because they've lived in Chicago and they're
right.
like, yeah, he's
and
right.
Like,
this is a great
move
city.
To Chicago, but what about Los Angeles and New York? I'm like, what about learning how to act?
Yeah.
Not only is there ample opportunity to do that there, but the city is affordable.
Yeah.
Like I had my own apartment. And I was making no money and it was like $500 a month in a nice neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I had money left over to pay for improv classes and to go out and see music and to see other theater and to also be in I mean, it was like, it's an artist's town.
Oh my God. That's what mm-hmm. absolutely, I was going to say soup yeah. to nuts. Don't even know where that comes from. But
yeah.
every person
soup
I know
nuts.
Who lived in Chicago was like, I sort of wish I were still there, or just the exposure to culture in so many different forms they felt like was just abundant, just the way you're saying, for sure.
Yeah. And you know, I on as a theater actor bought a house there.
That's great.
Was able to the mortgage was $1,000 a month, which is insane.
Yeah.
And you know, you can work in the theater and have kids and own a home and all, do all the things that like a normal working person does and still be creative in that way.
Were you, once you were settled in there, were there opportunities to do on camera stuff that you were
totally
getting? And
yeah, like the movies that come through. I mean, now it's totally different because Dick Wolf has come in and set up, you know, all the Chicago Med, Chicago Fire, Chicago, and they all shoot there, and they are constantly rotating people through those shows.
Yeah.
And at the time there were a few shows there that would come and go. And then, you know, the Dark Knight movies, the Batman movies, and, you know, movies would come through and TV shows would shoot pilots there. And so there was opportunities for it. And the first pilot I shot was there.
Was it about fire, police, hospitals, or law?
Yeah, it was about law and police.
Fantastic.
I think it was called something justice, like, and it was Jason Isaac, the amazing British actor playing some kind of like lawyer / detective.
Okay.
And we got into a half nude Russian bathhouse fistfight.
How wonderful.
And that was my first pilot.
Bottom half nude, I'm assuming. Top
bottom,
half shirt.
Wearing shirts.
Great.
No pants.
Great. That's a Chicago way.
Yeah, it was a direct ripoff of Eastern Promises, that film. Like you saw
Yeah, it really was.
Literally that scene. Literally that scene.
Oh, that's so funny.
In the bathhouse. And Jason Isaacs, thought that I was a stuntman and not an actor. And so was just full on kicking me in the chest all day. And of course, this is my first job.
So you didn't...
I didn't know to...
There was no conversation had.
I didn't know to be like, hey, can you stop kicking me so hard in the chest? Double feet donkey kick. Like, and I'm a young enough actor. There was a whole confusion, right? Because there were these two thugs. And it was like, you know, Igor and Rash were the two thugs. And I was playing Rash, and the other stuntman was playing Igor. But the stuntman had this amazing port wine birthmark on his face.
Yeah.
Looking like he might be called Rash.
Right.
And so there was this huge confusion about who had what lines.
Yeah.
And they started taking my lines away and giving it to the stuntman. Mm-hmm. But then they realized, oh, he can't deliver these lines, and started giving them back to me. And then by the time that was over, Jason Isaac was just donkey kicking me in the chest.
It's just amazing.
I didn't know enough. At the end of the day, I think the stunt coordinator gave me like a $175 a bump,
doing
like
your
a
work.
Stunt bump. And I was completely covered in fake tattoos, body tattoos, neck tattoos, like my whole body. I had 4 hours for one day of work like these tattoos. And then at the time I rode a motorcycle, and I was like, just leave them. They're
sure.
kind of fun. They'll wear off.
Yeah.
And I left set. And just went home.
Yeah.
And the makeup guy was like, you need to come back and so we can remove those. And I'm like, it's fine. I'll wash them off. And he goes, no, those are real Russian mob tattoos. And if the wrong person were to see you with those, it would be very bad.
Oh, my.
And I was like, holy shit.
Oh, yeah. Real life.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. Real life. Right. Not pretend life.
But yeah. So Chicago offered all kinds of opportunities. But the opportunity to live affordably and still be a creative person was kind of invaluable.
Did you get in early in your career, and maybe this still happens, but I seriously doubt it now with where you are, but did you, because of your size, did you get the sort of like, we need you to be a thug, or we need you to be a bouncer, or we need you to be, because there are so many small people
sure.
in entertainment.
Yeah, it works out very well in those cases. Beard is generally a tough guy, and then shaved is big dope.
Uh-huh.
I realized very early that my size was great for theater.
Yeah,
because being a large person on stage helps, and there's generally roles for people of all ages, but I knew for film and television, I wasn't going to work until I aged into my size.
Hmm.
Like you can't in film and television, there's not much to do with a 6'5", 23-year-old.
Right.
And so I needed to age into cop, detective, thug, like all of these things. And so sure enough, like I hit 30 and started picking up a lot of work. But
that's really funny. And what was the play that you moved to, that you and Rachel moved to New York for?
It was called Lombardi, and mm-hmm. it was about Vince Lombardi, the football coach. And it was Dan Loria and Judith Light were the two leads. And then a few of us played football players. And there was a woman I knew in Chicago who knew the casting director. She's like, if you're looking for football player sized actors, you should see this guy. And she said, we've already done the first round of auditions, but if he wants to fly himself out for callbacks, we'll see him. And so I borrowed $400 from my parents to buy a plane ticket and went out and auditioned for Tommy Cale, who, is Lin-Manuel Miranda's creative partner. He ended up directing what's that musical called?
Oh, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, Hamilton, I think it's called.
Uh-huh.
So he directed this play, and then that was it. We drove out and kind of Rachel, you know, kind of magically got a job transfer out there, and so she was working, and we were, yeah. It was nuts.
I have to believe that the amount of training by virtue of touring all of these different cities at such a young age would help. Like I think about the very, very few times I have had to like fly to New York for a test or something like that. And I'm not a super anxious person about auditions and stuff, but it's real hard not to get nervy when you're like on a plane going, I'm going to spend 5 minutes in a room with these people. And that's what all this is for.
Sure.
But for someone like you, kind of already associating like performing on stage and being on a plane and this and that, like, did you feel like that helped with stuff
absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely. I've described, you know, performing for me is like Adderall for someone with ADD. It focuses me and it like calms me, and it's the anxiety comes from everything else.
Yeah. Has that always been true for you? Were you a kid who loved getting on stage?
Yeah. Like the performative aspect of it. Which it comes down to, you know, seeking validation and things like that as a form of brain drug, as a form of getting that validation that taps into the center of the brain that distributes dopamine and serotonin and, oh, that's calming. Oh, that feels good. Okay, thank you. Thank you for those applause or whatever, laughter or whatever it is. And so the tour... As my theater mentor kind of told me initially, he's like, listen, it might not be Shakespeare, but what you are getting right now is your PhD in stage time. Like I played rooms anywhere from 200 seats to 2,500.
Wow.
And so to be able to
it was a one man show. Let's remind
everyone. And so to just stand on a stage with these words, it was like an 85 page monologue essentially.
Yeah.
That took 3 months to learn, like just to memorize, and then rehearsals. And like, I almost drove myself mad just memorizing it.
So you didn't write it.
No,
because that's interesting, isn't it? Like you don't see a ton of one person performances that the person who wrote it didn't write for themselves to then perform and tour.
Right.
With.
And
that seems very unique and cool.
There's a reason for that. Like it's personal material, but this stuff was, you know, this was written, you know, in the late 90s. When the topic of men and women are so different, men be all like, and women like, and you know, all the every bit of entertainment was, you know, Home Improvement and King of Queens. And there was an interesting shift happening of this strong, beautiful, powerful woman and this idiot oaf man.
Right.
And it was an interesting, defending the caveman was kind of a loving response to the idea that, listen, men are all pigs, men are all assholes, and that's just the way it is. And the culture had kind of gotten to a point where it was, men were kind of like, yeah, you're right.
And crack me open another brewski, because
and it gave people permission, to just be that, And this play was really sweet in that it was like, we have these differences, and here's why. And it came from this like anthropological and sociological thing of like hunters and gatherers and how we used to function in society and how we had these roles and how it's kind of developed now and why we do things differently. And yes, we are different, but no one is better or worse. And it was really kind of fair and balanced and made fun of men and made fun of women. And it was the longest running one man show in Broadway history and still is. That's crazy. And so it tapped into something at the right time to where it was like, let's get back on the same page here and remember why we like to partner with each other. Mm. And I think it was a really, it's interesting when you are in a coupleship and you think that your problems are unique, or you think that like the thing that your partner does that bothers you is only exists in your little bubble. And then you go to a theater, and if it's a 2,500 seat theater, let's say you sit with, you know, 1,500 couples and they're all laughing at the same thing. It just kind of disarms all of those things.
Which is also, that's very comedy. I mean, in general, that's very like, go see a stand-up show and sort of have that experience, or go see improv in some cases.
Yeah, and this guy was a stand-up comedian. He wrote this thing, Rob Becker, he wrote this thing in response to the death of the comedy boom. Hmm. All of these comedy clubs were closing. He didn't have as much work. And there were these theaters, these comedy rooms. And so he wrote this thing and then did it in San Francisco for 6 months and kept this comedy club open with this thing. And then did it in Dallas and then did it in Chicago and then went to Broadway and all these things.
I'm surprised I haven't seen it. I'm not surprised that I haven't seen being on Broadway, because I just was a terrible going to see shows person in New York, because I'm not a planner.
No.
So I would always be in New York and be like, maybe I should see a show. Oh, I checked for tickets and the half price tickets seemed so far away. Like just very sort of like, I didn't have that hunger to see theater that a lot of my peers have. And now I feel kind of ashamed of it. Like I've sort of started leaning back into that, going like, this is a very important part of what we do. And even the if you're not the person on the stage doing it, you're gaining so much as a human being, but also as a, as it a crafts person.
Yeah. And sparks inspiration as far as like, oh, that's what's happening right now in the modern theater.
Yeah.
Which informs everything. Like all of those actors leave to go do film and television, and those directors are off, you know, directing television as well. So it's they're all connected. But doing the show after a certain amount of time, you know, it was understanding what it's like to stand on stage just in front of that many people and have the first 20 minutes of your show not go well and get no laughs. So 20 minutes, let's say there's only supposed to be one laugh a minute. So you've tried 20 times to make these people laugh and they haven't. And now we have over an hour to go. So what are we going to do?
That's intense.
How are you going to adjust? How are you going to shift? What are you going to do? Can't speed up. Can't really slow down. What are you going to do differently to connect and let these people know that everything is okay?
Right.
And you're going to be fine. I'm going to take care of you. We're going to get on the same, like it was almost like a science experiment. But after a certain amount of time, like after memorizing that much, I can memorize 5 to 10 pages in a matter of minutes.
Sure. And how long do you retain that after you've used it for whatever purpose it needs to?
It's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I dump it.
Yeah.
The file dump is pretty quick.
Yeah. Did you have tricks that you would, I mean, that sounds like sort of callous, but did you have, like, as you came to understand the way different audiences were reacting and kind of getting a sense, again, like you said, a science experiment, that you might have a certain group that only reacted to this one kind of joke and you sort of go, oh, they're the crowd that doesn't get anything up to this point, or they're the crowd who clearly feels uncomfortable with maybe this sort of vibe, but they allow themselves to loosen up at this point, and in my past experience, this usually means they soften up from here on out.
Absolutely. Like, did you have? Yeah. I mean, over time developed probably 4 or 5 different ways to deliver each joke, depending on how everything up until then had gone and how I wanted everything after to go, and was able to, in the moment, pick one. So there were little tricks. Like what I would try to do if it wasn't working was pick a person. Like, even if it's 2,000 people, I would pick a person, like four or five rows back, and deliver the show to them. And if I could deliver it to them and get them laughing, then it feels less like a guy on stage talking and someone talking to someone else.
Did that person, were you making eye contact with that person?
Yeah.
You really just like isolate.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I would pick one in the middle.
I wish I could find one of the people that, well, I have a surprise for you. Could you come in here, please? This one person
from
whose
Atlantic
life was
City.
Changed. I really felt like he was looking right at me. It's reassuring to know I was right.
And it turns out he was. Uh-huh. And I'd pick one person off to the right, one person off to the left, and one person in the middle.
Got it.
And try to deliver it directly to them. But yeah, I mean, there were times when I'd forget the words and be just alone on stage trying to figure out what I had just said and what comes next. And I would just be honest with the audience about, I have no idea.
What. Oh, you would?
Yeah. And it's a stall tactic.
Right.
And they think it's hysterical.
Right.
They love it.
As long as you, I mean, that's the thing, right? As long as you seem like you are fine with whatever's happening, there's some sort of like, that's the trust, right? That the audience is like, oh, I don't have to feel bad for you because you clearly are fine with whatever's going on.
I've had a brain malfunction and I don't remember what comes next.
Yeah.
And they'd laugh.
Also, you're by yourself. So I'm sure there's a baked in sympathy that's like, I couldn't do what you're doing. Take your time, please.
Yeah.
You know?
And I'd say, no, I'm serious. And they'd laugh again. And I'd, What did I just say? What just came out of my mouth? And someone would yell a key word or something. Yeah, that's right. That's what I just said. And what comes next? And just kind of walked them through it. And there were there was one time where I was like, you know what? I have to go.
Really?
And I have to go get the script. And so I literally walked off stage.
Do you remember where that happened?
Yeah, it was somewhere north of Chicago. It was a one-night gig where somebody had hired the show to come, and I drove myself up there and went backstage, and I was still on mic, and they could hear me, and I just kept narrating. Let's see, we're about page, and they could hear the pages turning, and they could hear, like, let's see, about page 65. Just talked about TV and the football, here we go. And found it and walked on stage and kept going, and people just assumed it was part of the routine.
When that happened, did you still have a feeling of a course of adrenaline? But you played it off.
Yeah.
And we'll move on from this in a second because I'm really psychoanalyzing. Mm-hmm. But do you think that there's anything to the fact that it wasn't part of a big tour, it wasn't part of a big run, it was something you drove to? Do you know what I mean? And so was there any part of you that after the fact were like, I wonder if I was less connected because I was so comfortable.
Sure. Where I was like,
just hop in my car.
You know, this auditorium.
It's a one-nighter. Just, you know, outside of Chicago on the burbs. Yeah. I think I can handle this, everybody.
Yeah. And I think I was probably just a little cocky and
Hubris, slipped. Illinois.
Sure.
Was the name of
Hubris,
it.
Illinois. Welcome to Hubris. Yeah.
Yeah. What, when you were in high school, did you have in Sacramento a robust theater program in your high school? Did you go to a private school?
Yeah,
public school.
I went to a private high school. I went to public school up until then, but then I went to Jesuit high school in Sacramento. And there's a man there named Ed Trafton who ran the theater program.
Co-ed or just boys?
This was all boys, but we had, at the time, we had two all-girls schools, St. Francis and Loretto, who actually, this was kind of the best part about all of our extracurricular co-ed activities is any of the girls from any school in the school district could come participate in our activities. And so theater was a co-ed activity and was an amazing like social experiment.
Yeah. I know, it feels like, it would feel to me like maybe like you cracked a code or something.
Yeah.
Like you stumbled upon something
was like nobody knows about this.
This is a huge in.
And the guy who ran it was just this amazing creator, and he still runs it, and he's still turning out amazing shows and amazing performers and like heavy duty artistic stuff, not just, you know, they'll do Spamalot and they'll do the lighter musicals, but they also did a play called God's Country, which was by Stephen Dietz, which was about white supremacist and white nationalist groups in California. Yeah. And a true story about an assassination of a radio personality. Oh, wow. And these men who went on trial and the discussion of, you know, all of these. So you've got 30 Catholic school kids dressed up as Ku Klux Klan members to end the first act.
Wow.
With a cross burning.
Oh my God.
And so he treated us all like adults and treated us all like artists. And so it was a real fun place to be.
What kind of stuff what roles were you getting? I say this as a person who was getting the mom roles.
Well, we're tall.
Like if I'm tall.
No, we're tall.
That's the only way you convey adulthood.
I played the dads.
Right.
I played the older people, the thugs. But that's why theater was kind to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you date girls in that world?
Not really dating. It was flirting, and I didn't have like my first real girlfriend until senior year. But yeah, all the relationships were in that world. But yeah, I always felt like I was. So one of my best friends to this day was a couple years behind me in that program. She's like my wife's best friend now, and one of our, and we actually lived with her in New York for the first 8 months we were there.
Oh, bless her.
Two-bedroom apartment.
Wonderful gift to give to someone.
Yeah. And her name's Victoria, and she remembers it differently. Apparently I was more popular and desired than I remember being, which maybe is how it always is. But I certainly felt more awkward and uncertain and kind of I don't know what the word is, unmoored. Like I floated around a lot. I floated between theater, but I was also a competitive tennis player
and went to
Loyola Marymount on a scholarship for tennis. And so I would go between the jocks and the theater kids, and my two best friends and I were skaters, and so it was like this weird, like I just didn't feel, which was great, I felt like I belonged kind of everywhere but nowhere. Mm-hmm.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And I do think that's something that a lot of people feel when they don't have that I felt the same way. I would have a really close friendship with maybe one person. Mm-hmm. And if that went away, I realized, I'm not part of any. I'm not really part of a group per se. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you fit?
Did you find that you had friendships that went away?
Yeah.
Do you think that happens more for women than for men?
It might. I mean, yeah. I think I had friendships that went away because there were unrequited feelings on one side or the other that just made it too hard to just be friends. Right. I guess. And then I did have some of those like just fierce, like passionate.
So you were friends.
Platonic,
you were friends with someone, but you wanted to be romantic with them,
or vice versa, or would like I had a lot of straight boy friends. Mm-hmm. From a very young age, and sometimes it would go a direction that I didn't know was even a possibility. Mm-hmm. and then I would be like, no, where are you going?
Yeah.
No, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything wrong. Why have I lost you?
Yeah.
You know, but I didn't want to sound like I was like a heartbreaker or anything like that, but just every once in a while there would be one that was like,
but I was,
but I really was.
Boy, let me tell you.
Yeah. I gotta say, I love tennis and I cannot play it much because of just various ongoing shoulder things from flying off a bike onto my back. But
when was
it makes it hard years ago.
Still.
But it just keeps cropping up.
Yeah, well.
Mm-hmm. It's always ready. It's always ready to explode and become the center of my world.
Yeah, tennis is an odd sport. It's especially for young people. It's like this individual sport that requires a great deal of mental stability, which young people do not have.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't play it at all as a young person.
Interesting sport to grow up playing.
Yeah. How was that? Was that something that you kind of discovered on your own, or was that the kind of sport where your dad or your mom had played and you sort of brought into?
Yeah, my dad played, and then, you know, like the thing that was, we had like this racket club near our house that was also like, that was just like the center of everything. It had the swimming pool and the tennis courts and the kids programs. And so we just made friends there. And in the summertime, it was, you know, ride our bikes over there and participate in whatever was going on. But at 6'5", you know, I was built for it.
You cover a lot of ground, as I'm sure everyone said from the very beginning of you picking up a racket.
But again, the mental aspect of it was just a lot to. I was 90% of the players at my age groups were head cases, because it's just insane. It's insanity inducing being in an individual sport with that much pressure and not having like a team to lean on or anything like that.
Yeah. Do you play for fun now? Is that something you can...
Once in a while I will, but now, you know, my knees and hips and shoulders are all, you know, tricky, but it also like triggers a bunch of weird old...
Well, yeah, that's a question, right? When you do something like that and have that relationship to it, can it mellow out to become just like a fun leisure activity?
Right. And that, I think maybe that's why I felt disconnected from things in high school too, because if I wasn't at play practice, I was playing tennis. And so socializing was not like, I went to two parties, quote unquote, in high school.
Oh, wow.
Because I was training and I was traveling and I was on the weekends, I was going to tournaments and I was, you know, all of these things. And so the people I played tennis with were a totally separate group from anybody in high school.
Yeah. What about the skaters? They weren't getting you into smoking a bit of pot once in a while?
No.
That seems like a tough thing to be dedicated. Like, the skater friends I had in high school were very dedicated to becoming great at being on their board.
Sure.
But they were absolutely still, like, smoking a ton of weed and, like, drinking and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know,
like,
I think I was...
Discipline-wise.
I was pretty... the fear of God was put into my heart as far as, like... the danger of those things,
like on a literal religious level.
I meant that more metaphorically.
I mean, you went to a Jesuit school, so
we went to a Methodist church, which is like about as liberal and progressive a Protestant organization as you can find.
But you definitely, it stepped in for you. It sunk in
it wasn't even that. It was more just like my parents were... I don't know if you saw the photos I sent you, but I was like a Boy Scout.
Such a big Boy Scout. But you look like a fully grown adult with all of those adorable badges.
That was the last year.
Yeah.
And I was like 16.
Yeah.
And we had this troop that took like Boy Scouting to like what you really think it is. Like rock, like climbing mountains,
survivalists,
throwing hatchets,
right,
shooting black powder, like like living in the wilderness, like doing grown-up things. And so there was a group of about five or six of us who were in high school doing the Boy Scouts. And my best friend growing up, he and I were in this troop together. We both got our Eagle Scout badges. He's now a major in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
And so my parents had these things where it was like, if you accomplish this by the time you're Eagle Scout, by the time you're 16, stay away from drugs and alcohol, all these things, we will get you this. And in the background of that photo, you'll see there's a bright orange 65 Mustang. That was the goal.
Yeah.
And so if I had to stay away from that other stuff to get that, that was no problem. Yeah. I didn't really have my first drink or anything until sophomore year of college.
But see this, and this all that even just you. I mean, each thing that you're adding on to your agenda as a teenager that you're telling me, again, aside from skating, but even that is a thing that it's really hard to be naturally immediately good at. So you do have to be willing to practice and do it and fall and get hurt and get up and do it again. So there's a lot of discipline. There's so much discipline going on in there.
Too much discipline.
Too much.
Yeah.
But maybe not the worst thing in the world for an actor, because you have to have that internal clock, which many people find out the hard way.
Right.
You know, some people never have to find it out because they go through the weird time warp where suddenly they're on a show and they don't know what that means.
Right.
But a lot of people have to be very emotionally and mentally disciplined and sort of have the, you know, a long-term marathon in mind. Well, and it seems like you were given that, whether it was all for the best or not.
And the discipline, I think also there's a mindfulness involved with those types of things to to be called to do something in your life, you can be just as easily called away from that same thing at some point. So to know, I'm a tennis player. I could, at these different junctures, really step it up and take it to a different level.
Yeah.
If I get this coach and I spend this amount of time and I do this thing, I could, or this could be the end of tennis for me. Now, at age 19, to walk away from something that I've spent 10 years training, that my parents have spent countless hours and amounts of money on, and just to be like, yeah, I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
Is not quitting as much as it is being called away from it. It wasn't where I wanted to be. It wasn't where I was supposed to be. It was literally breaking my body down and my mental state down.
Yeah.
And so, like, figuring out what your purpose is in this life is very important. And so my purpose is not to be an actor. My purpose is, I believe, is to reflect emotion. And I do that through artistic expressions, whether it's music or theater or photography or conversation or whatever it may be. And there are many ways to do that, obviously. But we only identify our purposes by identifying our passions and the things that we're passionate about. And once we can identify that purpose, then we have to obey that purpose above all else. Because if we don't have that locked in, it's difficult for let me put it in the I form. If I don't lock that in, then I don't trust myself. Then I don't love myself. Then I don't feel like trying.
Right.
And then if I feel all of those ways, then the people around me don't quite trust me, don't quite want to connect with me, don't quite want to share with me. Relationships become hard. Romantic relationships become hard. Friendships become kind of arm's length.
Noted.
Yeah.
And appreciated.
Thank you. And so to really be honest with ourselves about what our purpose is, not how we, there are people who are healers, there are people who are connectors. There are people who who create joy. And they do that through comedy or through actually being a nurse or being a physical therapist or being a cook, a chef, or there are thousands of ways to be creative. And I think it's all creativity that don't involve acting or painting or,
sure.
or singing or
could
or
not
music.
Agree more.
And so that type of discipline, to bring it back around to what you were talking about, I also have to be disciplined with myself in when to walk away from an idea. And it's happening right now, just in small ways in this new house with my wife. It's like, okay, we get set on an idea and we're like, this is how it's going to be. And we don't analyze the idea any further because we've decided that that's how it's going to be. Even if it's the wrong idea, we stop entertaining other ideas. And a lot of times as is discovered in writers' rooms or in the creative process, you have to explore all of the wrong ideas in order to know what the right idea is. So I think that discipline in that fashion has kind of served me like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's hard. It's hard, especially when, you know, this is like very much something that gets brought up all the time in all different kinds of conversations nowadays, but we do have what feels sometimes like the burden of too many choices or too mm-hmm. many ideas or yeah. too many. And so, you know, it's completely understandable why any of us at any given time would hope to settle on something quickly. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it does feel organic mm-hmm. and sometimes yeah. it stays organic and, you know, but there are absolutely times, I think, for all of us when the safest choice feels like to make one.
Sure.
And then to stick with it, sure, because it's great, terrifying to imagine done, like, yeah, the lists of things and, yeah, the this and what about that and what if, oh, I forgot about this.
Right.
But I think you're right. I mean, I think absolutely giving yourself a break in the way of like, just because I'm open to this, right, not working,
right,
doesn't mean that I'm standing at the edge of a chasm.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I'm doing, yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean, because I'm doing that right now with my life. So I'm on this television show that is doing very well, and I could rest here. And I do in many ways, and it's a really wonderful place to be. But I've also started writing music and playing music and performing under this different name, you know, of Joseph the Spouse. And I've also started this podcast with my buddy Michael Rosenbaum. And both of those things, as much as I love them and I feel fulfilled by them, I am completely terrified by doing them. I'm like, you want to know what would be easier than doing this podcast? Not doing this podcast.
Right.
This is too much bullshit. What do you mean? Domain names and social media accounts and service providers and, oh, right, editors and producers and booking guests and promoting and like all this shit. Where I was like, why do I want to do this? Why do I want to do that? Like, and it's so ironic because the podcast is called In Love with Michael Rosenbaum and Chris Sullivan. And I'm in this 10-year relationship. Michael is 43 and has not had a long-term relationship for a very long time. And we've just gotten kind of sick and tired of the kind of ironic view or the cynical view of things. And we want to talk to people about the things that they love and the things that drive them and the things that make their life full of light and love. And we hope to take all of that information like soul vampires and,
sure,
improve our lives.
Sure.
And prepare Michael for a long-term healthy relationship.
Oh, okay. I got it. It's a fixer-upper.
I mean, it's kind, I mean, he's, this is, and I'm sure you'll talk to him, but it's like, he's a sincere, heartfelt, generous, good-looking, intelligent, funny human being. So
what's happening?
So what's the next step?
Right.
Yeah. Where are the blocks?
Yeah.
And I on the other side am this person who has this thing set, but how can I continue to challenge myself in my relationship to be better and to be a better performer and partner and lover and friend and all of these things? But there's a constant rotation of not wanting to do this and then, right, loving it. And then what the fuck is all of this about? And okay, I see what this is about. And just kind of like living in that cycle and not making rash decisions around any of it and just letting it cycle through has been an important lesson over the last year.
What are you playing when you're out playing music as Joseph the Spouse?
I'm playing songs that I've written mostly with a guy named Taylor Goldsmith, who's the lead singer and songwriter for a band called Dawes.
Mm-hmm.
And he is Mandy Moore's husband. And we met back when he was Mandy Moore's boyfriend. And he was like, yeah, I'm in this band called Dawes. You should check it out. And I hadn't heard of them, which is insane because they have like 8 albums and they are one of the greatest American bands today. And so I bought all 8 of his albums and listened to them in chronological order. And would like text him as I was listening and ask him questions about these songs. And I had written music in the past. And then
on guitar.
Yeah.
Principally.
On guitar. Yeah. And ukulele. And had kind of realized that we had similar styles and things that we enjoyed. And so one day I just asked him if he wanted to write a song. And we wrote a song in like 2 days over text message.
That's great.
And then we sat down and wrote a bunch more. And he produced the record. And we've got about 14 songs recorded. And we're going to be playing, let's see, we're playing our next show at Largo.
Oh, great.
Sunday, September 8th.
Okay, I'm going to write that down.
You'll get an invitation. You'll get a reminder. And so it's interesting to kind of step outside of the main way of creative expression right now and to write these songs and to perform them and to see how or if people connect with them and just kind of do something that's scary.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my friend's favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. You're hearing the voices of real litigants, real people who have submitted disputes to my internet court at the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I hear their cases, I ask them questions, they're good ones, and then I tell them who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks to Judge John Hodgman's ruling, my dad has been forced to retire one of the worst dad jokes of all time.
Instead of cutting his own hair with a Flowbee, my husband has his hair cut professionally.
I have to join a community theater group.
And my wife has stopped bringing home wild animals.
It's the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Find it every Wednesday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Thanks, Judge John Hodgman.
All right, I want to get into this MASH game.
All right, here we go.
I'm going to start with, because we just were having a conversation about music and collaboration, mm-hmm. let's say... three singer-songwriters, composers, bands mm-hmm. from any time mm-hmm. in the past, present, I'm not going to include the future, okay. That you may have the opportunity to collaborate with, mm-hmm. but if this person is no longer alive, clearly that's a sure. good choice for this sure. as well, because this is our fantasy
sure.
Ideal that you would love to collaborate with musically.
I would love to collaborate with John Prine. I would love to collaborate with the Avett Brothers. And I would love to collaborate with Jack White.
Fantastic. Okay. Next category is three places in the world that if getting there were not a headache in any mm-hmm. way, shape, or form, you would like to have a sort of a quiet getaway.
Paris, France. These are all places that I have not been.
Great.
That Rachel and I have wanted to go to. Tokyo, Japan. In case you were wondering which Tokyo.
Listen, there's a Paris, Texas. Hey, that's all that's I have right. to say.
I would go back to Galway, Ireland.
I haven't been to Ireland yet, and I'm so pissed at myself.
In 2 weeks, you could see all of it.
Right?
And it would be incredible.
I gotta go. It's and Scotland.
It's a great place.
And Scotland.
Are you Celtic in heritage?
Yeah. That's where a lot of my blood comes from. So yeah. from French and Scottish and yeah. Irish yeah. are the mains. Yeah. I mean, I really like that's so gross. And it feels like, especially in a world now where we are celebrating so many cultures that have gotten, you know, shit on for centuries, at least in terms of like where things happen in the States or elsewhere. I will say that like I am that kid that heard the bagpipes for the first time and was like, oh, that's my soul.
Uh-huh.
That's my soul talking back to me.
Yep.
Like, what is this? No. What is that?
I am not embarrassed to say that in order to read the Iliad in high school, I would put on the Riverdance soundtrack.
Oh.
In order to make it feel like an epic tale for myself. And I had to read it out loud or else I wasn't going to get through it.
That is
so I'm alone
charming.
I'm alone in my weird room listening to Riverdance and reading the Iliad out loud.
That's an image I welcome in.
That's an awkward moment.
To my heart and mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. So we've got our vacation homes. Now let's do three movies, films that you can step into. You're not reliving the plot. You're not a character. It's really just about being in that world with those people in that environment.
Singing in the Rain.
Great.
Amelie. Ghostbusters.
Get her. That was your plan. Get her. That's like such a small moment in Ghostbusters when
yeah.
that's what like Bill Murray says yeah. after that
get
was
her.
Get her was your plan.
Get her was your plan.
Ugh. What a throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
golden moment. Mm-hmm. Next category, let's do three foods that in this reality are either too expensive, too rare, too hard to find, too bad for the environment, too caloric, you're allergic. In this alternate reality, you can have it in perpetuity, mm-hmm. snap of your fingers, three.
You said foods, right?
Mm-hmm.
Guacamole.
Great.
Grilled cheeses.
Great. The way you said that almost made me feel like it wasn't a sandwich, but it was in fact grilled cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
Grilled cheeses.
Grilled cheeses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like grilled cheese any kind of sense either.
Grills cheesed. And three twins, a lemon cookie ice cream.
Oh, lemon cookie.
It's the best ice cream I've ever had. Hands down, no arguments.
Twins. Fantastic. Okay, next category, let's do three people. They can be fictitious characters. They can be real people from any walk of life that you can have as a sort of, you have the bat phone and you can call this person and they're delighted to hear from you and they sort of spread some wisdom. On whatever it is that you have a question about.
Call when I need help.
Yeah. Or just like, I want to be inspired. Or, hey, what were you thinking? Like you were saying when you were texting your dog's friend.
Yeah. 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 Who's that? That is, I would like to I'd get on the phone with Barack Obama.
Great.
I would get on the phone with Tracy Letts.
Great. Have you worked with him?
I have.
I'm sure you have, right? Briefly.
And I would get on the phone with Judith Light.
Great. Next category, places and times that you can visit, mm-hmm. whether it's an iconic moment in time or just an era that you would love to be able to hang out in. You have a safety bubble, so you're not going to get cholera or anything, unless you want to. Hey. Unless you want to know what it feels like to die of cholera, I guess that's acceptable.
If you're going to live life.
Right.
I would go to I would visit I'm not really going back to times of tension, but I would go to a Johnny Cash concert.
Nice.
At the Ryman Auditorium. I would go I'd want to see a lot of music. Let's try and mix it up. I would go back to, I'd go back to the opening day of Disneyland.
Oh, amazing.
I would go see A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Old Globe. Oh,
take me with you.
Yeah.
I remember what I was going to say earlier when I went on and on and on about Tucson and my magnet school history, which is your fault. But I was going to say that, and I believe it was Colin Hanks, if I'm not mistaken, because someone just referred to it the other day. But have you read Time and Again by Jack Finney?
I haven't.
It was written in the 70s, but it's I think Somewhere in Time, the movie stole the sort of mechanism through which you can travel in time. Mm-hmm. But it's a guy who is recruited by this mysterious organization to work on this very, very new way of traveling through time, which is that they've discovered that there are pockets in the world that are just close enough to how they've been for X amount of years that if you immerse yourself in that, it's sort of a state of mind. Wow. So he is placed like there's a place like around the corner from Notre Dame where it's like a quiet cobblestone alleyway. And at 3 a.m, you can go back to, 1600. And in his case, they set him up in a tiny little apartment in the Dakota that overlooks the park that the middle of the night, especially in the winter when it's snowing and it's muffling all the sounds, it's just like it was at the turn of the century. So he goes back to New New York as it existed when the Statue of Liberty was just an arm in a park.
Wow.
And the Natural History Museum was just a building surrounded by farmland and stuff.
Wow, yeah,
it's a great book. I highly recommend it for someone like
that's
you.
That's great. I love that.
Anyway, that's what I was thinking about when you were talking about these wonderful places you would go. Listen, this is you're going to do with this category what you wish.
Okay.
You have a solid relationship, a wonderful marriage.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're the kind of people that have like your lists or your crushes, but this is a MASH reality in which you have romantic, sexy times, long-term romance, don't care with anyone. I don't care if it's an animal, a man, a woman.
An animal.
A fox.
You might care if it was
I'm
an
saying
animal.
A fox is different than
yeah.
an animal.
Yeah.
I'm saying that because, as my listeners know, more than one
character.
Person has selected sure. the fox Robin Hood.
Sure.
That's that guy yeah. would get a lot of action.
Yeah.
And it could be something from your past.
Gillian Anderson, definitely. She was my first crushes watching X-Files growing up. Incredible.
I know. Have you watched the Netflix series, the British series that she's on?
Part of it.
Yeah.
Have you seen American Gods?
Yeah. Yeah,
where she plays,
I did not
like,
watch the second
the David
season,
Bowie,
but yes,
like
that was
internet god
fantastic.
And TV god.
Yeah,
and she's
her,
dressed up
her
like
appearance
Marilyn
was like,
yeah.
oh my god, you're amazing.
And she keeps coming back again and again. It's
agreed.
Amazing. Who is that person who plays Amelie?
Audrey Tautou.
Yes, Audrey Tautou.
Let's throw her in there. And it could be that you're saying Amelie. You don't know.
Yeah,
Audrey Tautou. We're saying Amelie.
Yeah,
the adorable Amelie.
The adorable Amelie, and. Lydia from Beetlejuice.
I knew you were going to say that.
How'd you know that?
So weird? In my head, I was like, he's going to say Winona Ryder's character in Beetlejuice, and then I was like, no, he's not. Why would that? Why would?
That's
why
such
would
a weird thing.
That?
Why would he say that? And then he said it. Wow.
You heard it here, everyone. I've already made my series about being a fake fortune teller, so I can't go back and do it over again. I'm
yeah, you have to go back and make your
marks.
Series about being a real fortune teller.
That's true.
Yeah.
Season two, everybody. Mm-hmm. Okay, final category.
Mm-hmm.
Three skills that right now you don't possess, but tomorrow we will have you wake up with one of them. You've sort of downloaded Matrix style. Suddenly you have absolute expertise.
To be a master pianist.
Great. And then just give me two more.
To be fluent in Spanish.
Great.
And... be a master, an opera singer.
Ooh. Yeah, that's one of those things that is just about as close to what I grew up, like, you know, sort of what my quiver of arrows is while still being the most alien.
Right.
Like, how could it be that close and also feel like it's from another planet?
So far.
Yeah.
So far.
Understood. Do you know how MASH works? I got to do a little squiggle that you tell me when to stop, and then I do my little eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
It's been a long time.
Okay. I'm going to do, like, give yourself a couple of seconds, but only a couple of seconds and then tell me when to stop. I'm starting now.
Stop.
Okay. I'm going to pause this. I reassure the listener it will seem as if no time has passed, but I will come back with your 100% guaranteed fictitious MASH future.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I'm feeling real solid about our results. First of all, what I'm going to drop on you is, I don't know, these three things seem to really blend harmoniously with one another for some reason. So I'm going to go ahead and just like let you know all of these at once. Number one is this magical ability to go back and visiting opening day of Disneyland, I think would be quite marvelous.
Yeah.
I think a very, very good person to do that with you is Amelie.
Absolutely.
For her sense of magic and wonder.
Absolutely.
And then I don't know why it feels like the fact that you are an expert pianist kind of works there. It's almost like you could sit in with like one of like the early sort of like the New Orleans Square. Exactly.
Yeah.
And just like tickle the ivories to everyone's delight. I want to, of course, this is going to come in handy for your musical collaboration with the Avett Brothers.
Yep.
Which, I mean, let's be honest, that could be imminent if you're already working with a member of Dawes. That feels like
it's true.
Those are cousin bands, if not brother bands.
I do know the Avett Brothers.
Okay,
I know
them.
And I would really,
I apologize that I said Avett Brothers.
Oh, no.
Hold
on.
No, I'll write
a formal
apology.
I know the Avett Brothers as well.
And You know the Avits and the Avits?
Yes. And I'm just throwing, I just put them on the list to like send that out into
it's
the universe.
It's out there.
You know what I mean?
Both yeah. sets.
You've recorded
of brothers.
It.
People it's are out there.
Hear it. Yeah.
So congratulations on that.
Thanks.
I'll tell you right now, all your musical chops are also going to come in handy with your ability to jump into the film Singing in the Rain.
That's right.
As you see fit.
Excellent.
It's one of those movies I had forgotten about, rewatched a few years ago, and had forgotten how satirical it was.
Yeah.
I just did not have any memory
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Satirical and like 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really something.
Yeah.
So good on you for that. You also have the ability to just teleport to your beautiful vacation getaway in Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
which is worth having a place in.
Yes.
I've been there and
yes.
I approve your choice.
Okay, good.
I don't know the level of quality of their guacamole there. So I'm pleased to tell you that you have the magical ability to conjure guacamole at
God.
A moment's notice.
That's probably the best thing.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if you'd wish for sushi, it's like, hey, what a waste.
Yeah.
You're in Tokyo. You're going to get it.
Yeah. And
the guacamole you need access to.
And since they don't have it there, I'm going to make a ton of money.
Yeah. Oh,
a ton of money.
The guacamole king?
They're going to love
it. Of Tokyo?
Yeah. Chris
yeah.
Sullivan, guacamole king of
Big
Tokyo.
Big time. And then finally, I'm going to tell you who enjoys, and this, by the way, a house in Tokyo, which
right.
that's, you know,
right.
not an apartment. So there's only a few neighborhoods I can offhand think
sure,
of.
Sure, sure.
And there's one neighborhood that actually reminds me of Venice, California.
In Tokyo?
Where there's like little bungalows and stuff.
Oh,
it's so
perfect.
Unexpected. It's like, oh, this is like a one-story neighborhood
Excellent.
Amidst this giant
huh.
cosmopolitan
city. Very expensive,
city.
I bet.
I'm sure they're very expensive.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Who cares? You're
that's
the king
right.
of guacamole
that's
and
right.
you magically got it. For nothing. And
right.
and listen, you know who's going to be a fun guy to talk about all of this with is Barack Obama.
Yeah, he's going to love
it. He's going to be down with all
yeah,
of
yeah.
this. My new friend Chris Sullivan.
Yeah.
Again, I said this offline, very smug.
oh,
deeply
instant friendship.
Smug. Whether or not it's mutual, it doesn't matter to me. I now feel that we're friends.
That's it.
I do have one last piece of business to address with you
yes.
that I did not warn you about in advance,
Uh-oh.
Which is that because I only interview gentlemen during the summer and I call it my Boys of Summer series,
mm-hmm.
and this is Steve Agee's fault, who you may know
mm-hmm.
because I think you guys were in a movie together.
Yes.
I do ask that you extemporaneously try to sing a bit of Todd Henley's Boys of Summer.
Now that the boys of summer have come, I can feel it. Sun keeps shining, the sun.
I genuinely did not expect falsetto from you.
Back.
I mean, that was a
sunglasses on, baby.
Yeah.
How much do you have the rights for?
I mean, zero.
Okay, great.
But you put it, you scrambled it just enough.
Great.
So thank you for that gift.
Yeah.
Could not have been less prepared for falsetto. You made my day.
Don Henley's got
in every
that
way.
Voice.
It absolutely is. It's up there. Thank you so much for doing the podcast. I look forward to having Michael on.
Listen to the high five.
I look forward to listening to your podcast,
yeah,
and I can't wait to come
Michael
to your music
Rosenbaum
show. I'm very excited
Rosenbaum.
About this. Friendship, friendship,
yeah.
friendship, friendship. Where would you like, if people wanted to come see you, do the show, etc., find out about your newsy news, where can they find
yeah,
you?
Yeah, follow me on Instagram, at Sullivan Graham, so I'll give you all the updates for any shows while we get the website and everything put together. On Twitter, I'm at Sullivan Tweet.
Fantastic.
And yeah, the podcast In Love with Chris Sullivan or In Love with Michael Rosenbaum and Chris Sullivan will be coming out at the end of August.
Fantastic. As you know how this works, I'm going to actually talk to you next time on the podcast. The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.